Rolling? Okay, let's get the road on the show. Call to order. Meeting of the Oceana Community Service District for Wednesday, October 10th, 5:30 p.m. May I have the roll call, please?
Director Gibson?
Present.
Director Villa?
Present.
Director Replogle? Vice President Austin? And President White?
Present. We stand for the flag salute, please.
Ready, salute. I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Thank you. Move on to agenda review. Have we got Ms. Cassiola?
Madam President, we don't have any changes on the agenda. When we do get to the consent agenda, however, I'm going to make a couple of introductory remarks, brief remarks, and then I'll also ask that we pull accounts payable for separate consideration.
Okay. Thank you very much. Yes.
And then I have a couple additions, President White and members of the board, to item 8B. We have a modified staff report. And the items that have been added to disbursements are listed on the backside. The total is for $766.38. This adjustment will take cash disbursements from $64,596.53 to $65,362.91. So when you take that item, it will be as amended. So it be.
Thank you very much. Move on to report of closed session, and then we'll move on to closed session. Mr. Minery, sir?
Yes, seeing no public to make public comment on the closed session item, the board will adjourn to closed session pursuant to Government Code 54957. This is public employment, general manager, district engineer, / assistant general manager.
Call the meeting back to order at 6:08 p.m. May we have a report out of closed session?
The report out of closed session is no reportable action.
Thank you very much.
Madam President, if I might, after item number 6, public comment for items not on the agenda, I would recommend that we proceed to agenda item number 9A, which is consideration of a recommendation authorizing the board president to execute an agreement with One Cool Earth, because our representatives from One Cool Earth are here to provide a presentation to your board.
I would support that. So we'll start first with the public comments for items not on the agenda. The public comment period provides an opportunity for members of the public to address the board on matters of interest within the jurisdiction of the district that are not listed on the agenda. We ask those comments be limited to 3 minutes, and I see no one coming forward. So we will now move somewhat out of order to item. See, you take me out of order and I get lost. Business item 9A, consideration of a recommendation authorizing the board president to execute an agreement with One Cool Earth, a 501(c) Corporation to provide $9,980 in funding to support the Earth Genius Education Program at Oceana Elementary School.
And today we have with us the prior executive director, Greg Ellis, who was here last year as well, and the new executive director, Dan Kano. Kano?
Yeah.
Kano. So it's your show.
Thank you so much for having us. Got some pictures here to make it a little more interesting. And how much time would you allot to us? I don't want to go over.
5 minutes easily. We're not counting. Tony, could you cut the lights a little
efficient.
Bit? Thank you.
All right. Well, I'm Greg Ellis. I'm the former executive director. I just stepped into a new role focusing more on fundraising and development of the programs. So I'm grateful for your time tonight, and I just wanted to walk you through our program and our proposal a little more. And because this is a second-year proposal, it's fair to give you an update of how your money was spent last year and how we plan to use this year's funding in an extension of that. So our credo is basically that gardens change lives, and we look at the garden at an elementary school especially as a very influential classroom that takes into account all sorts of issues such as health, education like science education, wellness, natural resources, and environment. And that's really what we use our gardens as, platforms for these topics. So last year we received a grant from you to run our program, and I'll get more into the details of our program. I think there's some new board members here, and at the end of this slideshow I've got some more details of how the program works. But last year some of the highlights were accomplishing a waste audit at the school. So we took an entire day's worth of waste, we had the custodian save it, and then we brought out the kids and brought out the pile of waste and just mixed them together and had the kids sort out the different kinds of waste. We had a tarp, you can see the tarp there, and classes would come out for 15 to 30 minute intervals, and we've got our wonderful educator there in the brown shirt, Jen Lawler. She's a local retired teacher who works as our educator at this school site, and she's overseeing this. I happened to be there on this day myself too, just to really see what was happening. So the contrast is very poor, but the results of the waste audit were really revealing. And if we can adjust that at all.
There we go.
So on the left, we have over 100 pounds of fruit and veggies. And yeah, so I can just read them off. On the left, we have over 100 pounds of fruit and veggies that wound up in the trash. So this is one of the nexus between health and waste for us. You know, it's creating a waste issue because students aren't consuming their nutritious food. And so we're trying to combine those two issues and approach them at one time in the garden. And having the students out there seeing the waste in these categories pile up as part of that effort. At the end of the day, we had all the waste sorted, and then we brought all the classes back, and we presented, and we said, look at how much you're not eating. And it was like a garbage can full. Fortunately, this school has worm composting, so they can take the fruits and veggies, they can dump them in the compost. They break down, and then we can use them in the garden eventually. We also had over 50 pounds of food scraps that weren't compostable in our worm bins. Those are grains, those are meats, cheeses, milk, that kind of things. Liquids, actually the milk is in the liquids. We had over 50 pounds, about a gallon, 5 gallon and a half of milk that was poured out. So, using the garden, which seems more like a health platform, to also combine waste is really highlighted here. There were many other categories that we sorted, and even some categories not on this bar graph, and we challenged the students with each of those categories. How could we avoid producing waste in this category? And if we do have to produce waste, how can we divert it, make sure it goes into the right bin? And so this school has been really good about, after lunch, they now have recycling and compost bins. Before, they just had one bin that everything went in. Now we're at least separating two of the main categories, so there's very little landfill waste remaining. These are some pictures of our school garden science lab. We used some of the grant funding last year to build a new garden. We have this.
This is the original site of the garden here before it was installed. And we had a group of Cal Poly students come in, and they worked really hard. And in one day, they built these beds, moved in a bunch of wood chips, brought in all the soil, and really renovated the space. Here's our wonderful educator, Jen, again. We also got a donation of pre-made beds to the school. So this school has several garden locations now, and you can't really walk anywhere without noticing the gardens. And so Jen Lawler, she showed up at this school site every week for the 36 weeks of the school year and spent the whole day there bringing classes out to the garden and teaching lessons. Now, one of the reasons that we exist as a nonprofit is because a school garden is really hard for the school to run alone. It usually falls on a teacher or a charismatic parent. And, you know, if you're a teacher, you have your own classroom, you have your own classes. It's really hard to take on the garden as an extra thing. And so the gardens often fall into disrepair. If you're a parent, maybe you get a lot of energy building the garden, but eventually you move on and, you know, your kids go to middle school. So we see our role at this school as really, you know, creating a contiguous program year after year that can really build on itself. So part of our program is also to involve kids in the preparation of food. Studies have shown that the more you can get kids involved in preparing their food, the more likely they're going to eat it. And so we literally put knives in the hands of kindergartners. They're safety knives. They're just serrated nylon plastic knives. And we teach them the claw and the saw method. And we have them cutting up things. We give them little chef hats. We made empanadas and lettuce wraps. So they actually got to use some herbs harvested from the garden for the lettuce wraps. And this was a very interesting event. I attended this as well. And we had one family show up and they said, you know, we're living in a motel right now, so we don't have a kitchen. We don't have a place to prepare food for our kid. And this was a really meaningful event for them. We also, through some complimentary grant funding, we were able to take a field trip to the San Simeon Coastal Discovery Center. And these are some of the students doing a plankton lab and learning about water quality and how what you do on the land through the watershed is really tied to the ocean health. And so they captured plankton, looked at them under a microscope, measured all kinds of water quality indicators, salinity, nitrates, phosphates. And, you know, they also had a nice day at the beach. We did a little litter pickup. So our goals for this year are similar. We really want to continue what we've started there. We're excited to participate in the November 17th outreach event that your organization is hosting, and we're hoping to showcase some of the things we've been doing. This site recently was awarded a substantial amount of money to install water capture infrastructure. So they have put in some landscapes that capture some of the runoff and really sink it in instead of sending it down the streets. So we're hoping to show off some of that. We're going to have another family cooking night. Teacher training and support is important to us. We want to be more than just the educator that we hire to be at the school site. We want the teachers to be empowered and involved. So in the past, we've operated
teacher trainings. We give away our curriculum to these teachers. We show them how to use it, and we even give them some supplies so that they don't have to go out and buy extra things to teach the lessons. We want to support continued composting, give tours of the existing low-impact infrastructure at the site. That's the water infiltration infrastructure. And we have another year's funding to do a field trip to the Coastal Discovery Center. So that's an overview of what we did and what we want to do. A little more detail on our program. You know, this school is one of the highest need in the county. It's got 88% of the families with students there who qualify for free and reduced meals. 29% of the students have a health risk due to body composition. That's from the state physical fitness testing. So, you know, that's one in three kids practically that has a health issue. So bringing health into the program is really, really vital, and, you know, being able to make it relevant to those students. 82% Latino and 58% English language learners. So we do have some of our curriculum that we've, you know, looked at in a cultural context and said, how can we make this more relevant? How can we make our recipes culturally relevant to this audience? So Gardens Change Health, you know, this is one of our students, actually, not from this school site, but from another school site. This generation is predicted to have a shorter lifespan than their parents' generation. And so, you know, we're seeing Gardens as being able to address that. Elena is planting veggies. She's planting broccoli. She's developing a relationship with that food. And it can help her overcome neophobia, which was a new word for me, but it's fear of new things. And that's one of the main reasons that kids say things are yucky. They're afraid of something they don't know. It's probably a good survival trait. You don't want them eating poisonous things, but it's kind of gone the other way now. You know, our educators try to make healthy food cool. A lot of food choices are about peer pressure and having a supportive environment to try new things. And then just learning food skills, learning how to identify broccoli. Does a kid even know to ask for broccoli? Do they know to ask for kale? So we're trying to introduce these things. 50% of fifth graders are not proficient in science. And that's, you know, has a lot of impact on their personal lives as far as how far they'll be able to go in a career. And it has a lot of impact in our civic lives too. How much do they know about the decisions that they're making as informed citizens? How much do they know about the decisions that we're making? So Gardens make science fun. They're a living textbook. They bridge what the students are learning in the classroom with the real world. And students get to be involved. The middle picture there is students at Ocean View Elementary installing a garden. And then Gardens, you know, they change how you feel. And they're showing that most kids are only spending an hour or less time outside every day. So the more we can get kids outside, away from their screens, in the sunshine, the better they're feeling, the happier they are. They're taking responsibility for their school, beautifying their school, connecting in a positive environment. So we make sure that schools have a garden. We make sure they have the infrastructure. We make sure they have an educator. And then we try to make sure that there's a sustainability plan in place so that that garden continues for the long term and it really becomes part of the school culture. And, you know, we have a goal to reach all 43 schools in the county, you know, as soon as we can. And so this having funding from you is really helping make that possible. And these are some of our other sponsors. We got your guys' logo. Every time we give a presentation, we're happy to, you know, share our partners. Some of the testimonials, some awards that we've won. And this is my last slide. So you're already donating generously, and we look forward to partnering with you on into the future. And I'm happy to answer any questions. And Dan might want to say hi here, too.
Thank you. Hi, Dan Cano. If I could just add something really quickly. I came out of the nonprofit sector and social services over the last few years, and then I went to work for the food bank the last year before I jumped on board with One Cool Earth. And the one cool thing about One Cool Earth is it permeates a little bit of all of that. We work with the food bank really closely because we get some food for them to run our classes. We communicate with the Safe System of Care here, which is a social services family resource center at Oceana Elementary, and some of our families have a lot of crossover. Our family cooking nights, we have dads sometimes show up for the first time, and you know, social services, the big push is to try and get dads involved. So I think that's what's really great about this organization and why I'm so passionate about it, is it really does link a lot of different organizations and passions, but also community. And so, thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Anybody on the
board? I have a question. So on most of these events, or do all the children in the school get to participate?
Jen is an amazing teacher. So in a day, she often reaches 200 or 300 students. There's about 500 at the school, I believe. So it's hard to reach every single one,
right.
But she is amazing. And, you know, we track how many students she's reaching every week. So.
Okay. Thank you.
Good question.
Anyone else? Question? Comment?
Yes.
How early do you start? Like kindergarten, first grade?
Yeah, I mean, the earlier they can get out there and start tasting things, the better. We have lesson plans that we've created that go all the way from kindergarten to actually even to preschool. So preschool to middle school we're targeting.
What are you actually growing? I mean, you've got to be quick, stuff that'll grow quickly.
It is. We developed a good relationship with Greenheart Farms.
Okay.
They're they grow veggie starts, and so they give us these trays every 3 or 4 months. They give us a tray with about 200 little plants in it. So we get whatever they're growing usually, but it's often lettuce, broccoli, cauliflower, kale, chard. We grew a lot of celery this year. We've also been letting some of it go to seed so the kids can see the full life cycle. That's one of their standards. And then they can collect the seed, too, and even grow it again on their own. So.
Okay, so a lot of the green stuff that grows quickly.
Yeah, in a cooler
coastal
climate. We can't do very many tomatoes.
Neither can I.
I think we had maybe a squash plant over the summer that is yielding now. So.
Yeah.
And is this throughout the school year?
Yes, and we even stick around for the summer when no one's there and make sure that the garden's getting some basic maintenance. So.
You had talked last year about the trying to get some lemon trees or orange trees. Were you successful at all?
Yeah, we've had to hold off on trees just because they're doing all this bond work at the school.
That's
so
right.
Everything we build, we have to have portability in mind. They might kick us out of there next week, but it's looking pretty safe now, and we're hoping as the construction settles down, we'll really be able to get some fruit trees in there.
Because I always thought some lemons and oranges would hang on the vine a long time.
I think we might have a couple trees in wine barrels. We had a parent donate some wine barrels, so I think we got something in there.
Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah, this looks like a very beneficial program from a lot of aspects. So thank you for coming and sharing about it.
Yeah, thanks again for having me. And I think Paavo has our contact information if you think of any other questions. If you ever want to just stop by and see Jen teaching, she's a really incredible teacher. So, yeah, thank you so much.
Well, I would entertain a motion. Does anybody want to make a motion?
Madam President,
oh.
We need to, even though we don't have members of the public.
Yes.
Still want to.
I forget. Need to call for public comment. And seeing no one come forward, we'll move on to making this an action item, I guess.
I'll make a motion that we authorize the board president to execute an agreement with One Cool Earth, a 501c3 corporation, to provide $9,980 in funding to support Earth Genius educational program at Oceano Elementary School.
I second.
It's been moved and seconded. All in favor?
Aye.
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 Opposed? Carries 4-0, 1 absent. Thank you. Thank you, thank you.
Could we get a picture with the board?
That's a good idea.
Could we post it on our Facebook and make an announcement?
Yeah.
Yeah, I've
got my phone. You should move over one anyway. No, move over one.
Get the logo and the
yeah.
Should we stand behind you, great leader?
Or you can come out front of the...
Oh, I don't think we
can. Or do you want to stand
Why don't you come behind with us, yeah.
Oh, there you go.
Put the mics down so they aren't in our faces. Yeah. Sit up, ladies.
Shoulders up, that's right. 1, 2, 3. 1, 2, 3.
I've got to be something.
Yes. Yes.
Oh, thank you.
Come on.
Thank you. Moving on to special presentations and reports, staff reports, field supervisor Tony Maraschino.
Good evening, board. Tony Maraschino. All right, for the give you the Lopez update. It's currently at 43.6% full, which is 21,521 acre feet. We had no SSOs for the month of September. We're still not taking state water. Lopez has currently delivered 254 acre feet, and we've currently pumped 140 acre feet. The pumping is going to increase, you know, as the year goes along. So we've had samples, 22 work orders, 8 USAs, 10 customer service calls, no after-hour call-outs, actually. We also had to replace 2 lot service lines going to homes on 24th Street. That is complete and paved back. That was a little interesting because there was a plastic pipe that went from the main across the entire street to the 2 homes. Excuse me. And it's not a direct shot, so it was about 8 feet off of where a straight line would be. So we had ended up opening up a lot more of the street than I would like to have. So we did have to rent some plates that were, you know, 10 by 8. They were just bigger than what we stock, some road plates. We also had truck maintenance. We had to repair a pump at Well 8, the chlorine pump. Still continuing to sewer jet when we can. Lancaster, it's actually in Arroyo Grande. It's from the 50s, and it was a galvanized pipe. The saddle and the galvanized pipe kind of corroded. So we figured we're just going to run 2 new services. Once we excavated and saw that the saddle was... it rotted away. Just from the water squirting out, it actually cut a hole into the main. So we had to end up shutting the main down, replacing about 6 feet of water main, and then get everybody back on before we can run 2 new services on Lancaster. And that job's almost buttoned up. We just got to get the paving company out there, and they'll be out there next week to get it paved, and then we can get our road plates back. We're still continuing to do meter changeouts. We actually yesterday replaced the valve on the north end of Air Park. It's an 8-inch water valve that we had to get it replaced due to the existing one from the existing line that is no longer there. When they poured the thrust block, it engulfed the valve and the 45, so we could not use that no longer since we got to run a new water line on the east side of the bridge.
Ouch. I just said ouch as in costly.
Yeah. So when the guys went to shut down the water main, there was a valve that wasn't on the map. And I don't know if you know the timeshare, the condos from the Elks Lodge across the way. Well, here's the operating nut that broke off, and it's a 21-year-old valve. And Jason said he only turned it a couple times, it snapped. You know, no big deal. We didn't think anything of it. So when they got the valve installed, they turned the water main back on. That valve is actually an isolation valve for all the water meters going to that complex. And it was about 4:15 when we got it all back on. You know, no big deal. We tore up the street real quick, and the operating stem, we just put a pipe wrench on it, turned it right back on, in and out within an hour or so. But it's amazing what the beach environment does, and this is, you know, below the street. You know, I was just amazed. Yeah, we have a little bit of trash pickup throughout the past couple weeks when we find stuff here and there. Any questions?
Now, that valve was in the sand?
No, actually, the body of the valve, this operating nut, we put a 8-inch pipe that goes around the valve.
Yeah.
So it keeps it basically free of debris so you can always turn on and off valves. So, no, this is not typically in dirt.
Yeah.
You know, some debris does get down in there.
But it wasn't. Yeah.
Yeah, okay. It's probably about 3 feet below grade, and it's got a box and a metal lid on it.
Yeah.
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 But no, it was clean, but just.
Yeah, I have one question. Where's Lancaster?
Lancaster's off of it's either off the Pike or Elm, so it's the city of Rio Grande that we service water to.
Yeah.
Yes.
I wasn't sure quite where it was. I was trying to think because don't we serve some other areas?
We do.
Trailer parks, and isn't there another? No, the other area we just wheel water to.
We wheel water. We service areas. Yes. We have a few of those.
Yeah.
Different locations.
Thank you.
Yes.
Anyone else?
No. Just as a quick clarification on your questions, President White, for the new board members. So there are residences within Arroyo Grande that are right along the pike that we provide direct service to. And then we also wheel water, which is the general term for just using somebody else's system to push our water. And Arroyo Grande services some of our customers. In that case, though, we provide Arroyo Grande with the water supply. When we provide water to Arroyo Grande's customer, we use our water supply as well. Just because we're in a better water situation than Arroyo Grande. But those are the two types of sort of cooperation that we have with the other cities where we provide some of their customers direct service, and then they provide some of our customers direct service. But in that case, it's with our water.
Thank you for the explanation.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Thank you.
Manager Ogren, I believe you're
next. Member, President White, members of the board, couple of items. One is with respect to LAFCO, because at the last board meeting, some of the motions included correspondence with LAFCO to determine whether or not our recreation powers were active or whether they were latent. And I placed a quick call, and David Church, the executive director, did some reading and gave us feedback that our recreational powers are considered to be active right now. So that was one of the two issues that we discussed, and we have a good response on that, which means that then moving forward with working with the school district and developing an RFP for the local nonprofits is our next steps. today had the Zone 3 Technical Advisory Committee meeting, and much of that topic is really going to be part of agenda item number 9D with respect to the low reservoir response plan and potential contract amendments, so I won't speak to it anymore today, other than the approach that I described to them that I would be recommending today was generally supported by the Technical Advisory Committee. And then third, on the Water Resource Reliability Program, I met yesterday with Cannon and Cleith Harris and Associates. And Cleith Harris is the sub-consultant to Cannon, and they've completed the draft report on the injection study. It's really good information, so we'll be able to present, provide board with members with copies in the near future, and then discuss it at an upcoming board meeting as well. But a little bit of the preview is that the Halcyon area is a very good recharge area, as is our existing water yard. Both of them are good sites. Our water yard would provide more direct benefits within Oceano, and then Halcyon would provide benefits for more of the multiple agencies, and the way that the water would flow underground would also help with the city's well field. So both of those are definitely viable options. And I'd be glad to answer any questions.
Thank you.
So the next steps for activating or exercising our active recreation powers, what's the timeline on that? Or
in the next,
any additional direction?
No additional direction is necessary. It's just a matter of timing and workload. But our most immediate steps then are to talk with the school district because we want to make sure that they're informed of the steps that we want to take, and then to draft a request for a proposal.
Thank you.
Seeing, we'll move on to Board of Directors, outside committee reports. I don't have any. Let's just start. Cynthia, you have?
I didn't have any meetings, but I would like to mention that the Oceano Advisory Council is holding a voter forum on October 18th. It's going to be managed by the League of Women Voters. They're going to have people presenting the pros and cons of the various propositions and Measure G. And that's going to be here at 6 p.m. in lieu of the regular OAC meeting.
Oh, okay.
I have nothing to report.
I have nothing to report either.
I have nothing to report either. It's kind of a slow time of year, I think. Or did I forget something?
No, Director Replogle, do you know if there's a flyer prepared or anything on the October 18th?
Yeah, I just got that this afternoon, and I can forward it to you.
To put on our district website? Yeah.
Okay, call for public comment, and seeing no one, we'll move on to consent items, although I think we're going to rearrange. Wasn't one of those going to be pulled?
Yeah, let's go ahead and do public comment on consent.
Public comment on consent. And seeing no one coming forward, we'll move on to consent agenda items.
So just to initiate the consent agenda is a little bit of clarification of the consent agenda. The idea is that the items are supposed to be relatively routine and don't involve much board discussion. Now, as a matter of protocol, every board member has the right to have an item on the consent agenda pulled for separate consideration. Examples might be you might see a number of the items on the consent agenda that you're okay with, but there might be one that you're not okay with and you want to vote no on a particular item. And so the appropriate then is to pull it for a separate consideration. Likewise, if there's just one that you want to discuss in some level of detail, then it's appropriate to pull that for discussions in a separate vote as well. But short of those two items to pull for separate consideration, it's still appropriate for quick questions, if there's any, you know, quick questions on the consent agenda, to ask them, or clarification, or if there's something that you really like, you know, to mention that as well. So that's all fair. And I mentioned it today because I want to pull item number 8B, which is review and approval of cash disbursements for separate consideration. And so there's an invoice that we got from the Pomo Community Services District that I want to discuss a little bit. But other than that, my only other introductory comment is really with respect to 8E, which is the proposal by South County Sanitary Service to increase solid waste and recycling rates. I wanted to put it on the consent agenda because by actually including it in the agenda item, it becomes a notice to the public under the Brown Act that something is afoot. The idea, though, that that itself is going to have subsequent formal board actions. It's part of a Prop 218 process. It requires multiple board actions, and none of those steps are being taken yet. It's just, again, the idea that South County Sanitary Services has submitted the request, and our recommendations included in here are just to coordinate with our neighboring cities. But that was a little bit of preview or, you know, clarification questions. But again, I would like to discuss 8B separately. And the normal protocol would be then, unless board members have separate items for separate consideration, then actions would be on items 8A, C, D, and E.
Can I entertain a motion, or do we have more questions or comments? Or
yeah, I had a question on the minutes for May 9th. President White, you're the only one present. Can we pass minutes? Those minutes.
I have been attending the meetings regularly for some time, but my dog had surgery that night, so I know I was not here.
Mr. Minery, I believe we can actually.
I thought so, but I wanted to clarify that.
Yes, you can still.
Okay.
Yeah. Otherwise, we would be hamstrung from doing lots of things.
Right. So I'll make a motion that we approve the consent agenda, A, C, D, and E.
Second.
It's been moved and seconded. All in favor?
Madam President, on item number D is a resolution, so we need to have a roll call vote on that.
Oh, excuse me. Yes, a roll call vote, please.
Okay. Director Gibson?
Yes.
Director Villa?
Yes.
Director Rapolgo?
Yes.
Vice President Austin? And President White?
Yes. Passes 4-0, 1 absent. Now we'll move on to consent agenda item B, review and approval of cash disbursements.
Yes, and Madam President, during the introduction of the agenda overall, Ms. Cassiola had expressed that we had changes on our recommendations and provided those and described those. So those recommendations, if supported by your board, would result in a motion to approve cash disbursements as amended. And then secondly, the question is whether you would also want to approve the invoice from the Pomo Community Services District. The background on this particular one is that I meet with the water agencies from time to time, and there was a discussion about doing some community advertisements for water conservation. And then Napomo went ahead with it and sent us a bill. I never really agreed to pay for anything, and it was sort of one of those situations where a whole bunch of people are nodding their head around the room, And so the NCSD representative just assumed everybody was okay with it. And I had a discussion with him a few weeks ago and said, well, you know, you just can't assume those things, that people, when it comes to money, don't have to speak up and say no. It's your obligation to round up with them and confirm that it's a yes. Yesterday, while I was doing a presentation at the quarterly meeting or local meeting of the California Special Districts Administrator, their finance and accounting manager was kind of elbowing me about this same invoice, and in part because way back in the day we had accounting and management classes together at Cal Poly, so we know each other pretty well. And I reiterated to her that her general manager really needed to get confirmation of yeses as opposed to assuming a yes when there's silence. So I specifically did not, you know, authorize or commit Oceano on this particular bill. As we can see, all the other agencies are paying for it. Our cost would be $557 and 14 cents. I don't really think that there's a budgetary issue of a expenditure of this magnitude. But I did explain to them that one of my sensitivities is that when it comes to Arroyo Grande, Grover, and Pismo Beach, we don't share in some of the costs that they are expending. They utilize consultants for staff extension work, and that really adds up to tens of thousands of dollars every year. And we stopped doing that in 2014 when I was hired. So I explained that, you know, in principle, I've kind of approached this as the same thing. But, you know, the truth is the dollar amounts are significantly different. So there would be goodwill with NCSD to pay it. And I think I've made the message loud and clear as to the fact that in the future they really need to make sure to confirm that we're in agreement on something as opposed to assuming silence is a yes.
Do you know if the other agencies have paid?
Yes, all the other agencies have paid.
Oops. Well, I would support the fact that we should pay it in the spirit of good fellowship, and I would assume that some of our constituents probably heard the ads, maybe.
Yes, I heard the ads.
Yes.
Yeah.
So, entertain a motion, or?
And so if the board is so inclined to support it, then it would be to approve staff recommendations as amended and with the inclusion of the invoice from Napomo Community Services District.
I think it's good that you made the point, though.
Yeah.
Next time that won't happen.
I'll make a motion that we approve the cash disbursements and the invoice as amended. Have a second?
Second.
It's been moved and seconded. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Carries 4-0, 1 absent. All right.
And then just as a point of clarification, one of the details that Nicole, and by the way, welcome to the meeting today, Nicole, is, you know, we keep track of check numbers as well. And so this particular item that was approved does not have a check number associated with it. So when we produce the check and we get it signed, we'll report back at the next meeting on that particular check number.
Okay. Thank you. Okay, moving on, I believe we can move on to all the rest of the business items. And prior to that, I will call for public comment. Seeing nobody come forward, we'll move on to 9B, consideration of a recommendation to approve a resolution adopting the district's standard construction contract and the district's general conditions for projects informally bid pursuant to the California Uniform Public Construction Cost Accounting Act. And is this not some of the stuff that we also considered that last meeting? Yes.
Yes, President White and members of the board. So item number 9B, the documents were introduced at the prior meeting, and what we provided was a red line strikeout version. Legal counsel went through it and had some modifications. Some of them were formatting modifications or cleanup, but the substantial ones were that we did modify the discrimination language that's included in the general conditions to now be consistent with the language used in state law, deleting a little bit of language that was specific to the city of Santa Monica. Legal counsel also clarified that the district's remedies associated with delays, that the liquidated damages were not the sole remedies. Liquidated damages are part of remedies associated with delays, but if there's other specific damages that are concurrent with those delays, then of course we have other remedies that we can seek. Also included some specific language that apparently is important associated with bodily harm and damages, to specifically call out not limited to bodily injury or death. I had still left a reference to Santa Monica somewhere buried in the documents, and so that was found and deleted. Venues in San Luis Obispo County as opposed to just the state of California. I mentioned some formatting. And then legal counsel also, and I reviewed the question that Director Raplogo had on some of the court decisions on the use of the language of shall and versus must. And so we inserted language in there to make it clear that whenever we use the word shall, it's mandatory. And we did some background, or Jeff did, and on the court case itself. And what, you know, because there's a little bit of, you know, me that was, how can shall not be shall? Apparently on the basic review, the case seemed to be more of a statutory case, where the use of the language shall in a statute was interpreted by the court to not necessarily be compulsive and mandatory. And legal counsel can speak a little bit more to that. But the reason why that makes sense to me is that when we look at the variety of statutes that we face, or even the Code of Federal Regulations, they'll often use the word shall. But sometimes that's in the context of whether or not the statutes even apply. So if a local agency chooses to enact a certain power, and this is going to be a really bad example, but if we chose to enact recreational powers, then we shall do certain things. For example, if you're working with kids, you shall make sure that you have background checks on the individuals who are working with the kids. Well, if we never exercise that recreational power, then that shall doesn't apply to us. And statutes and regulations have that in many different situations. So I can see how that would apply, especially to statutes. In the abundance of caution, though, we are going to make sure to include the languages, including in contracts, which of course are different than statutory requirements, just to make sure that there's no question that shall means mandatory and may is discretionary. And I think that's the best I can describe as to what you taught me, legal counsel.
Any questions?
No.
The importance of this agenda item really is also the subsequent agenda item. So we want to make sure to get the standard construction contract and the standard general conditions approved so that we can also proceed with item number 9C. And with respect to Napomo, when we send them our check, we'll also send them copies of our standard construction contract and general conditions, because they were very much interested in them yesterday when I met. Maybe we'll charge them for them. $500 and some. Send them an invoice. I thought that when we were talking yesterday, they said that they would agree to pay. They didn't say no.
Bad.
I'd be glad to answer any other questions.
All right. Thank you for defining shell. Appreciate that. I just wanted to mention, not not for this particular contract, but in the future. I did notice the occurrence of the word workmanship in there. If we could be more inclusive and say workership or rephrase it in a different way that's not gender specific, that would be good.
I think we can clean that up. Yeah, because we could make that change as well.
So part of the resolution, what it does is it provides us the ability to make non-substantive edits.
Oh, okay.
So,
Or just exactly that type.
Entertaining a motion? Yeah, it is.
So, in the event that board members are so inclined, you are allowed to say, I move to approve staff recommendations, because they're written. You don't actually have to reread them all the time if you don't want to.
I just do that for the record.
I move to approve staff recommendations.
Do we need to include in that about the workmanship change, or is
no.
that one of your recommendations now?
No, we can. Well, again, as a non-substantive change, we can just take the general board comment and make those edits.
Second.
It's been moved and seconded. Roll call vote, please.
Director Gibson?
Yes.
Director Villa?
Yes.
Director Replogle?
Yes.
Vice President Austin and President White?
Yes. It was 4-0, 1 absent. 9C. Consideration of a recommendation to authorize the president to execute a purchase order for the replacement generator, to authorize the general manager to solicit bids for installation of the generator in accordance with District Ordinance 2016.1-1, to fill a notice of exemption pursuant to the California Environmental Quality Act, and to approve a corresponding budget adjustment in the amount of $85,000.
Madam President, because of the four parts of this recommendation, approval of staff recommendations is an easy motion again to make. The point of particular emphasis that I want to draw out in this is that I've been including a lot of the reference material in the agenda items or in the addendums, and I've been doing that primarily because we have three board members, just to sort of point back at, what we're relying on in terms of prior ordinances in order to make recommendations. I'm going to sort of slow down on doing that because I don't need to include it, but what I want to make sure to do is encourage board members that if you want us to send you a copy of, for example, in this particular case, a copy of Ordinance 2016-1, that you just let us know, and then we'll email you or get you a hard copy. But initially, I've included either in the materials or in the addendum sort of an abundance of documentation. And again, that's just in order to, get a feel for how these items are put together, and because we do rely on prior actions in many cases. The overall approach, though, is that the permits are all in hand. The county planning's permit in order to replace the generator is in hand. The Air Pollution Control District's permit in order to replace the generator is in hand. We obtained bids for new generators in accordance with district policy. We have to at least pursue three different bids, and we were able to obtain two. The third, which was Queen Caterpillar, did not have a generator that met our needs, and so they declined to propose on it. And the next steps are going to be really figuring out what the timing of the delivery of the generator is, so that when we go out to bid, then we can provide the appropriate guidance to the contractor. And that we'll do in the actual bid documents. Underneath the Uniform Act, your board doesn't have to approve all of the bid documents. What we have in front of you are the sort of the important documents that are going to be included in the bids. But again, once we have a good understanding of what the delivery dates will be, then our direction to the contractor will be often like we'll provide them a five-day notice. If we're going to get a five-day notice from Cummins that the generator is going to be here, then we will need to make sure to tailor the notice to proceed to the contractor to time when the generator is coming, because essentially when it gets delivered, it needs to be put in place. So upon approval of these actions, we do have a little bit additional coordination work that we need to do, make sure we understand timing with Cummins, make sure that we incorporate that into the bid documents, and then go out to bid. The good news is Five Cities Fire helped to obtain the grant for the actual generator unit, and it was my understanding that through the funding source, which is really part of health emergency response police and fire funding, and with support of Sheriff Parkinson, this was like the largest grant that they've been provided out of that funding pool. So normally they're a lot smaller for miscellaneous pieces of equipment, but we definitely got some good support at the county level and through Five Cities Fire for the $38,000 plus in grant revenues. And then the remaining cost of $46,000 will be covered from our public facilities fees. And so as a result, the discretionary reserves that you have will not be touched. And I'd be glad to answer any questions.
I have a couple. Number one, I need to be reminded where the generator is going. Is it going down there or out in front?
It is going between the sheriff's station and the old fire station in our vacant lot, where we've already got electrical equipment and right in there.
Yeah, I wasn't sure. The second one, I guess I could complain. I don't know why one government agency has to pay another one. We have to pay ACPD $500 to get a permit to put our generator in for safety of our citizens. And I understand it. They had to cut the permit. It cost money to do the work at their end, and they have inspections and everything, but it just sometimes doesn't make me happy when the government is charging the government and we're paying for all of it. Mm-hmm. I'd like to keep our $500 here. But
and we,
you don't want to speak of that, I know.
Well, we agree. We would like to keep our costs lower. We do look at it closely, though, and we had an example last year, which we brought to your board, and Nicole really helped to help get it resolved, where the State Water Board itself was charging us for our annual permit, for our basically our water permit, our water license for operating, but not giving us the discount for disadvantaged communities. And I can't remember what the swing on the dollar amount on that was, but it was pretty significant.
I do remember that.
Yeah, and so we made sure to follow up that and ultimately did get the discount for a disadvantaged community status.
Yeah.
Other areas where we're looking at cost-related issues are cross-connections on our water supply system that we get charged from county health. That charge seems to be a bit higher than it should be. But in terms of the other permit fees, I'm not really seeing any that are out of line.
Yeah.
It's consistent with what we should expect.
We're coming very close. It's only been, 6 years?
Oh, since the emergency generator has been out of commission?
No, since I started talking about how we need an emergency generator.
Because I think the generator might have been out of commission for longer than that.
Yes.
And we do have, we were informed that we have a PG&E is going to be have a power outage.
They have a planned interruption of service on October 19th for an hour in the morning and an hour in the afternoon to change out some transformers. And so it'll affect us down to the fire station.
Yeah, so we're going to have temporary generators brought in during those outages.
Okay. Entertain a motion on this item.
I move that we authorize the president to execute a purchase order for a replacement generator authorize the general manager to solicit bids for installation of the generator in accordance with District Ordinance 2016-1, file a notice of exemption pursuant to the California Environmental Quality Act, and approve a corresponding budget adjustment in the amount of $85,000.
I second.
Roll call. We do have.
Roll call. I'm sorry, roll call vote.
Director Gibson?
Yes.
Director Villa?
Yes.
Director Plogle?
Yes.
Sorry. Vice President Austin and President White?
Yes. Thank you. Moves 4-0, 1 absent. Thank you very much for all the work that's gone into this. It's been amazing.
Well, it would normally seem that getting a bid out for a generator replacement wouldn't be so difficult, but there was a lot of variables associated with it. And then when the county planning department determined that it was a vital public facility, that the generator itself was a vital public facility, that created additional work. But you know, in the end, it really the work that was needed in order to get out to bid on this, like the standard construction contract and standard general conditions, will end up benefiting a lot of projects in the future as well.
Yes, thank you. Thank you very much. Moving on to 9D, our business items, consideration and discussions of an update on the Lopez Reservoir water supply, including efforts to amend the low reservoir response plan, preparation of the habitat conservation plan, and the California State Appeals Court ruling on the application for a public trust doctrine to groundwater extractions and the duty of counties with direction to staff and legal counsel on potential Lopez Water Service contract amendments. Thank you.
Madam President, members of the board, I want to make sure that we go slow enough on this item to have dialogue and questions as I move through the discussion rather than necessarily waiting till the end. And it's because there's a lot of different moving parts here. So what I'm going to do first is sort of generally describe what are the three primary issues at hand. And the first is the contract, the water supply contract that Oceano has with the County Flood Control District for Lopez. And that contract has a certain, provisions in there. But the underlying premise is that it's a lose-it-or-use-it contract, that our annual water entitlement, plus we may be provided an allocation of surplus water in any given year, we either use that water in that given year, and if we don't use it, we lose it. And so for several years now, we at the staff level and at the technical advisory committee level, we've discussed the idea that the use-it-or-lose-it contracts in water supplies are really becoming archaic in California. And they go back to the day where if you didn't use your water in a particular year, that it was expected that you would allow somebody else to put it to beneficial use. Because water rights and the ability to use water, there's a the history is that you were expected to put your water to beneficial use, and if you didn't do so, it should be available to somebody else because nobody owns water. Well, in today's era where water conservation and best management practices are really all about making sure you plan for water demand and water supplies on a multi-year basis. And even if we're not in a drought, the expectation is multi-year water resource planning is the approach that we need to take. Well, under the use-it-or-lose-it approach, we have no storage rights in Lopez water. And so there has been this ongoing dialogue of trying to amend the contracts in order to establish storage rights. So that's one of the principles here that we're addressing is the existing contracts have use-it-or-lose-it provisions. All that really does is tell us to draw down the reservoir as fast as we can, and that's just not the most appropriate best management practices associated with water supply, and it's not the best management practices associated with a water supply's relationship to the environment. So that's the principal tenet that we're talking about in the contracts. Any questions on that? Okay, I thought that. So then there's two modifiers. One is the low reservoir response plan, and the second is the habitat conservation plan. So whatever that contract says about our rights to use water, and I mentioned there's entitlement water, and then there's surplus water. And surplus water is the water that wasn't used in the prior year, whether it wasn't delivered to the municipal agencies or it wasn't released downstream. And the downstream releases implied in the contracts is 4,200 acre feet per year. So let's say we only release 4,000 acre feet downstream for either groundwater recharge for agriculture or for creek flows for the environment. If we only release 4,000, or if the county only releases 4,000, and it's 4,200 acre feet implied, then that other 200 acre feet wasn't used. That goes into the surplus water calculation, and we get a slice of that in the subsequent year as surplus water. Historically, surplus water was a much greater number prior to the requirements that exist now for environmental releases. But with the requirements for environmental releases, which is part of the habitat conservation plan and has not been final after 20 years of work on it, we know that the availability of surplus water is always going to be constrained in the future. And whatever our local agencies were that were relying on surplus water in the past, that's just not something that we have an absolute contractual right for, and that's the water that is most likely now and in the future going to be made available to for environmental releases and not for municipal. So the low reservoir response plan, though, before that is how do our deliveries, how are they modified in the event of a drought? So the existing low reservoir response plan says that once the lake level is below 20,000 acre feet, and Tony reported a little bit ago that it's around 21,500 acre feet, and once the Board of Supervisors has declared a drought emergency, then we move out of the current normal operating protocol and we move into a drought response protocol. And those protocols in the existing low reservoir response plan speak to, one is that there will be no surplus water made available during a drought because we're in a drought. So how can we have surplus water? And then secondly, that our annual entitlements for water will start getting cut back. And they get cut back based on benchmarks. When we hit 15,000 acre feet, there's a 10% cutback. But there's prescribed cutbacks, and then there's what's called an adaptive management plan, which is that, well, when did we get to 15,000 acre feet? If it was on November 1st of a particular year and it's about to start raining, then we can, work with the Zone 3 Advisory Committee and say, well, maybe we don't need to do the prescribed cutbacks since it's starting to rain and the lake is filling back up. When we first initiated the efforts in the drought a few years ago, we saw that the 15,000 acre foot benchmark was going to hit in maybe July or August. And so on April 1st, the rainy season is over, and everybody knew that even though we weren't at 15,000 acre feet, we would be during the year. So through the adaptive management program, we called for the 10% reduction in deliveries on April 1st rather than waiting, till July or August. So there's two elements in there. One is prescribed, and then second is the adaptive management program. And, of course, the adaptive management program is the modifier to the prescribed actions. So the low reservoir response plan itself is the plan on how we all agree to cut back on use of Lopez Dam during drought emergencies. Now, the other provision in there, which is good, is that during these periods of time, we can store our water. And so Oceano, when we were in the drought and operated under the low reservoir response plan, we were saving significant amounts of our annual allocation in Lopez Dam. And in fact, we built up a water storage of about 2.5 years of our Lopez supply in the dam, and we were able to do that simply because we stopped using Lopez water and we started using more state water. We did so because in the event of the continuation of the drought and concerns that any water we had in storage on the state water system was not local. It was over in the valley. And so we wanted to make sure that water and storage was as close to home as possible. And so we utilized the storage provisions during a drought. The downside of it was that when the drought is over and the emergency was over, we had around 800 acre-feet of water in storage at Lopez that then we ended up losing, because once we exited the drought, we no longer have the storage rights. And so the modifications that have been discussed so far to the LRRP is to give us an extended period of time in which we can use water that we stored during the drought. And it's kind of a concept that everybody says, well, yeah, that only makes sense. What's triggered, though, is that County Council recently ruled that that type of a modification to the Low Reservoir Response Plan would require a contract amendment. And we really haven't seen, you know, the legal opinion on why they changed. Why does this require a contract amendment versus the original adoption of the Low Reservoir Response Plan did not require a contract amendment. In that case, all of the agencies approved resolutions that basically were waivers that said, okay, county, you know, go ahead and do this. To me, what it probably seems like is that in a drought emergency, the county has sort of a full range. They can, you know, they have that power to say, hey, we're in a drought emergency, and we can do what we think is necessary, or we can cut back on your water supply the degree to that we believe it's necessary in order to deal with this drought. And so in drought conditions, the LRRP was really, you know, everybody coming together and saying how that should work, even though the Board of Supervisors ultimately had the contractual authority to, you know, hit the gavel and sort of do what they wanted to do. Well, the revisions to the LRRP, where we're seeking to use water and storage for an extended period of time after the drought is over, my intuition is that County Council is saying, well, wait a second, we're no longer in that drought emergency. The Board of Supervisors no longer has a broad authority in the drought emergency, and we're talking about a post-drought period, so everybody's really got to approve this through a contract amendment. And nobody really disputes the issue associated with modifying the low reservoir response plan through a contract amendment. But what it does do is it puts us in a situation where we say, but we've been talking about a whole bunch of other contract amendments also. And some of the other contract amendments we've been talking about may, in fact, reduce the need for the low reservoir response plan, because if through a contract amendment we have a right to store water in Lopez that we don't use in a particular year, then that feature of the LRRP isn't any longer needed in the LRRP. The low reservoir response plan is still important for determining how annual entitlements would be cut back in a drought emergency and everything. But the need to be able to use water in storage on an extended period of time, that provision of the LRRP can go away if we get our greater goal, which is the ability to store water anytime. We also have a couple other issues that we've historically wanted to be able to store Lopez water at Lopez Reservoir. We've also expressed amongst the other agencies that we would like to be able to store state water in Lopez as well. And that is accomplished not through piping state water up to the reservoir, but it's accomplished through a contract amendment that says, hey, if we want to deliver some state water or have it stored, then the county does an in-lieu exchange. And so they deliver state water to people instead of Lopez water. And the one contract caveat that we need to be cautious in requesting the right to store state water in Lopez is the caveat that water quality requirements. So during the drought, what we saw was the water quality of state water really deteriorated. Salts, total dissolved solids, communities like Morro Bay that were almost exclusively relying on state water, we really heard taste problems and other issues coming out. The Lopez supply was always blended, so we didn't experience as much here. But usually in lieu exchange programs, there's a caveat that says, look, if the water you're providing to exchange it with the local supply, it needs to meet the same water quality requirements or it's not going to necessarily be approved. Today at the TAC, they asked me how important was it that we have the right to store state water in Lopez Reservoir. And what I expressed to them was, well, if the board supports and authorizes legal counsel and I to put some amendments together, then it's simply putting them on the table. And if other people don't like it, then we want to hear. And, you know, are we going to fall on our sword to try to get, you know, the right to store state water in Lopez Reservoir? Well, maybe not. It's not as high of a priority as getting the right to store Lopez water in Lopez Reservoir. But I think that when, you know, the bigger picture of talking about the challenges of the groundwater basin, the ability to exchange water supply, and furthermore, the uncertainties about how the groundwater adjudication and water rights and exchanges and whatnot might occur in the future, just getting the right to store state water in Lopez Reservoir may not provide us any benefits today. But what I would want to do is avoid the situation where we're going through groundwater adjudication and litigation and then find ourselves in a position where it's where we'd be going, boy, if we had the right to store water in state water, that would be great. You know, you kind of want to get that done up front. But the priority for doing that right now is not as great as it, you know, it's more of anticipating how things might unfold and whether it might be a good benefit. Now, the priority for being able to store state water in Lopez Reservoir really accrues to the agencies locally that don't have state water. So in the most recent drought, a couple of our neighboring cities were coming very, very close to running out of water, and their only option would have been to try to buy state water. The state water contracts themselves forbid the county from selling state water to somebody who's not a state water contractor. And so it's really in the five cities area, it's really Pismo Beach and Oceano that would be able to provide and help out the other agencies in the event that the drought gets worse than it did previously. So we do want to be able to put issue, you know, put language on the table with respect to the right to store state water, but that one's going to be looked at a little bit more closely by others. And then the third provision associated with contract amendments is a practice that's been occurring by the county, and quite honestly, somebody asked me, well, how come you didn't have a problem with it when you were at the county? And my response was, do you really think that I knew all those little details that were going on? Plus, I'm wearing a different hat right now, and so that makes a world of difference as well. But what happens is when Lopez gets shut down for operational purposes, there has been a practice where the county would deliver state water to non-state water contractors. And we simply don't see where that's allowable, and we've had some correspondence with the county on that particular point, which really hasn't been replied to, which tends to tell us that, you know, we've got a point. They just don't know. Well, you know, they're like, well, what do you want us to do about it? And we're like, well, we'll do something about it, I guess. So those are the three provisions that we want to draft. One is the permanent right to store Lopez water that we don't use in a particular year. Second, the right to be able to store state water through in-lieu exchanges and with the caveat of water quality requirements. And then third, we want to try to develop a remedy to this practice. And it's not that we don't want the county to stop, you know, delivering state water to non-state water contractors when Lopez is shut down, but the remedy itself may be financial in those situations, so that if one of the non-state water contractors says, well, if it's going to cost me some money, then I'm just going to, you know, I'll pump. The idea is that's what they're supposed to be doing right now. If they're purely a Lopez contractor and Lopez shuts down, they're supposed to pump. But in any case, I'm not expecting that if we make those draft languages that they're going to, you know, everybody's going to jump on them. What it's going to really do is initiate some more of the negotiations on contract amendments. I understand that a couple of the cities probably have to go to their city councils to get not just formal approvals to negotiate, but that they might expect a memorandum of agreement similar to what we developed for Five Cities Fire Authority. I don't particularly think that's necessary, but If they do, then that's okay. And the point is if we already start drafting some language, then they're going to have better insight as to, you know, what our requests are going to be. And it might alleviate some of the challenges that we've seen in the Five Cities Fire Authority negotiations. So that's the sort of the underlying principle for wanting to initiate some language amendments, get them on the table. And at the Zone 3 TAC today, they were concerned about, well, would this delay a contract amendment for the low reservoir response plan? And in part, I responded that, look, we need to get these different options on the table so we can review the different options and see where we want to go. But, and I think Grover Beach was concurring with me that it's not going to, if we get back into the drought this winter, it's not going to have any ill effects because we would just be entering into the LRRP. The challenge wasn't going into the LRRP. The challenge was exiting the LRRP. So certainly we have time in order to address how we want to work through these issues. I'm going to pause there again to see if there's any board questions.
Yeah, I have a couple questions. At the Zone 3 meeting I went to, Varda Keta, representing I think most of the farmers, had some concerns about with the storage model receiving downstream releases.
Yes.
And so if you could address that and maybe any other opposition that there might be.
Yes.
With other Zone 3 participants.
And so Varda Keta is on the Zone 3 Advisory Committee, and he represents agriculture. So the committee itself has representatives of each of the agencies who obtain Lopez water. There's an ag representative. There's an at-large representative. Mm-hmm. And I think that rounds out the committee. Some of our local committees also have environmental representatives, but I...
The different cities. And
yeah, each of the cities and stuff.
It's a good group.
And so what Vard is speaking to is actually, it is more related to what we are not going to propose right now. So in this discussion about, well, boy, you know, a number of the agencies, ourselves and PISMO especially, we want to have the right to permanently store water at Lopez Dam. Over the last 6 or 9 months, the county has embarked on an evaluation of, instead of taking the existing contractual approach where we have, where there's an annual allocation of entitlement and perhaps an annual allocation of surplus water, was moving it to an operational model that was more analogous to Whale Rock Reservoir. Whale Rock is in Cayucas. It's the parties are primarily CMC, Cal Poly, and the city of San Luis Obispo, and some water is provided for the community of Cayucas as well. And in that particular case, water that flows into the dam is just divvied up to the different agencies, and what they use, and what they don't use is still allocated to them as storage. Well, in the case of Cayucas, you don't have the big downstream release commitment. They do have some minor ones, apparently, but they're not feeding, you know, a lot of farmland and recharging the groundwater basin. And so when we're looking at options of how we might convert to the Whale Rock model, and that would take all the water in Lopez Reservoir and then, you know, divvy it up amongst the different agencies, then the question became, well, what happens to downstream releases? And it evolved a little bit because part of the discussion was, well, if we have to make downstream releases and an agency has already used their water, then they would go into a negative account balance. And I said, well, wait a second. You can't go into negative water. That just doesn't work. That's like us giving, you know, another agency some water and hoping we're going to get it back. And, you know, some of the other agencies might say, that's a great deal, but those of us who are in a better water supply, you know, it's not a good deal for us. And so then they talked about, well, we need to dedicate a certain amount of water and storage then for downstream releases in order to make sure that nobody has a negative, you know, balance in the reservoir. And that seemed to be going in an okay direction, and it may or may not ultimately, you know, address the concerns of agriculture. But the approach that legal counsel and I would take would not be that approach. It would be just sticking with the current contracts and saying, look, that water that is allocated to us in a given year, whether it's our entitlement water or whether it's our surplus water, we don't lose it. We get to keep it in the reservoir. And the reason why I'm inclined now to stick really closely to the existing contracts and really making just minor language modifications that are very important is this recent appeals court decision on the public trust doctrine and how it relates to counties' obligations in issuing new well permits. And the case is pretty darn clear that counties are obligated to address public trust resources. What are public trust resources? There are many. They include the ability to river raft down a river. They include recreational. The most dominant ones are the endangered species. Making sure to take care of endangered species and making sure to take care of habitat. And what it basically says, that this appeals court ruling, is that the counties must address public trust resources in issuing new well permits. What that does, though, in my mind, then, is it begs the question is, one is, we've got to find out if it's going to be appealed to the state Supreme Court and whether the state Supreme Court is going to uphold it or not. But assuming that they do, and I, as a non-attorney, am going to assume that they do, because of how strongly it aligns with the Mono Lake decisions, and Mono Lake decisions were the most significant environmental decisions affecting the state water board's issuance of water rights permits. What happened in Mono Lake, and I need to speak to this briefly because it might illustrate what we can expect on county obligations associated with well permits. But in Mono Lake, the Los Angeles Department of Power and Water had what appeared to be a perfectly valid permit from the State Water Board to do everything that they were doing. But what happened is that, all of their actions predated the California Environmental Quality Act, their operational plan predated the Endangered Species Act. You know, Los Angeles basically bought the Owens Valley, and in doing so bought water rights up and down the Owens Valley decades ago. And so all of this action predated, our environmental regulations and species regulations that occurred in the late 60s and early 70s. But it didn't matter because under the public trust doctrine, it simply requires them to still address them. And what happens is that, or what happened is that case ended up really expanding and requiring the State Water Board to address many, many permits that had already been issued, and including, although it's not the only reason, the water rights permit at Lopez is also an open item at the State Water Board. And so the State Water Board addresses its public trust doctrines by requiring us to or waiting for us to get through the Habitat Conservation Plan. Because by going through a Habitat Conservation Plan in addressing endangered species issues, then that's how the State Water Board is satisfied that its public trust doctrine responsibilities are met. In other words, the State Water Board does not take it upon themselves to make all the public trust determinations, but they can rely on other agencies to make sure that the endangered species are being taken care of. And then once the Habitat Conservation Plan is done, or, you know, it's going to vary from a case-to-case basis, well, you know, and then the State Water Board has the ability to modify water rights permits and all well, as well that's been addressed. Real quick side note, agencies have been able to take public trust resources and divorce them from public trust. And so the idea is, and it's sort of like an overriding consideration on mitigating damages of a project or something. Some projects create unavoidable impacts, and the local agency can override that and say, despite that there are these impacts, we're still going to approve the project, and no set of conditions is going to, you know, mitigate all of those impacts. And so what we've seen in public trust is a community that's on the beach, and it's a tidelands area, and they've gone through a process of developing findings to give away public land and to divorce a public resource from underneath the public trust. But that's, they've got to do that in a process that I don't fully understand, but it's got to be backed by appropriate findings and whatnot. So when we move back to this overall environment of the public trust and what is the duty of either the State Water Board or the counties in issuing new well permits, it just simply says that thou must address public trust doctrine issues. The public, and so then when we move forward to this particular case, which is the Habitat Conservation Plan for Arroyo Grande Creek, and I expressed this at the TAC today, it opens up the discussion of, in order to maintain creek flows, what's the obligation of releases from Lopez Dam versus the obligations of the county to curtail pumping along the creek? And so historically, the assumption has always been that if somebody was going to go in and curtail pumping along the creek, it was going to have to be the Federal Resource Agency that was enforcing the Endangered Species Act. And that's the National Marine Fisheries Services, who's responsible for steelhead trout, our primary endangered species in the creek. And in fact, Anthony Spina, representative of National Marine Fisheries Services, in plenty of public meetings in the past, has said, that's my responsibility to work with your agriculture. And the word work was not always, you know, well received by agriculture, because they know that meant curtail pumping. But this public trust doctrine decision opens up, you know, this specter of possibility that the county is going to have to take the position of addressing pumping. And the position for the municipalities is that we have an entitlement to water, and we're paying for that entitlement. We have surplus water that sometimes we get and sometimes we don't get. And we know that we're going to lose a lot of that surplus water because it was never guaranteed to us anyhow in order to support habitat. But if you think that supporting the habitat just means, county, that you have to release more and more water to the detriment of our entitlements, then you need to think more now, because this court ruling is pointing to you have a responsibility, if necessary, to curtail pumping. Now, there's going to have to be a lot of factual evaluations associated with that. You know, how much does agriculture pump in comparison to their appropriative rights permit? How much does agriculture pump in comparison to riparian rights? What is the additional benefit that agriculture gets above and beyond normal permits or water rights because of the releases from Lopez Dam? And how do those compare to surplus water numbers and what's ultimately necessary? But the point is that appeals court, if it holds through a Supreme Court, could very well be a game changer. And so what I want to avoid right now is changing the operational model to the Cayucas model. Because what that would happen is we would take our existing contract rights and we would basically toss them out the window, and we would go to a new operating model. And we have to think really hard and fast before doing that, because the unintended consequences could be significant. Right now, we have an entitlement language in our contracts. And there are other cases out there that show that entitlement language is strong. Again, we're not talking about a drought situation. We're talking about normal operating. So I just don't see us going to that Cayucas model that agriculture was concerned about. In some ways, with this change in precedence, they might want to actually jump on it. But it's, you know, again, our focus is going to be purely on taking the existing contracts, minimizing the language that would be necessary in order to have the right to store Lopez water if we don't use it, you know, state water, and we'll see where that goes. And then curing the remedy that we see is an error in existing practices. But I just do not see us going to that Whale Rock model at all, because, you know, one of the things with these kind of court cases is that we all look at them and we think that we understand where they may be leading, but until those subsequent court cases happen that really, you know, solidify it, We don't really know what the full effect of some of these decisions are. But not knowing means that we don't want to change our operating model. You know, we want to stick with the entitlement-based operating model right now and simply try to keep it simple. And ultimately, if none of the other agencies want to change, do some of the amendments that we might propose, this revision to the LRRP would still be a good move. So part of the discussion today is we're not talking about options that we don't like, you know. We're talking about one option that we already know is on the table that we like, and yet are there other options that are going to be better? And so that's kind of the overall scenario. I want to check my notes real quick to... So again, the quick summary is we have a contract. It's a use it or lose it contract in terms of our water supply. The Lowell Reservoir Response Plan modifies our rights during droughts. The Habitat Conservation Plan modifies our rights in order so that the primacy of environmental laws can be complied with. We want to put some contract amendments on the table for storage at Lopez Dam, and we want to avoid moving to the model like Whale Rock because of the potential for unintended consequences.
So we're kind of taking the lead with these amendments, and then we're going to see what the others within Zone 3.
How they respond.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay.
And part of it was, so we, at the last TAC meeting in September, I'm on the phone, I was participating by conference call, and the county says, oh, by the way, county council said we need to do this one by a contract amendment. Does anybody have a problem? Well, unlike the $500 invoice associated with Napomo where I was silent, last month I was not silent. I said, yeah, I think I have a problem with it. And then I got off the phone and I called Jeff within about a half hour and I said, you know, Jeff, if we're going to say no, then we need to work to provide options, right? You just can't say no and you know, whatever. So that was kind of what I expressed today, too, is that, we're concerned about the existing approach, and so we'll be proactive to, you know, get it on the table and then see how everybody responds. And Ron Munns, who's the new Water Division Manager at the county, afterwards he caught me, and he was, thanks for that delivery. And he goes, I was worried that Oceano was going to use its clout. And I was like, hey, Oceano's got some clout. I hadn't heard that one yet. So.
I have a question. Are we going to get into a Sigma? Is there any Sigma impact in this also? Because it was mentioned in the stringent ground, you know, the other ground management thing that the state's doing.
Well, the way I read that ruling, that it said the Sigma does not displace the public trust doctrine.
Correct. Yeah.
So it's like the public trust.
Water rights in California have always been complicated, and they are getting much more complicated very quickly. And I agree with Director Gibson's reading on that. You know, we have three primary things that are going on right now in California water law. Adjudications, which we're involved in the Santa Maria Basin, and those are generally exempt from Sigma. There's some detailed provisions in there that we need to address in our case. But again, if you're in an adjudicated basin, the idea is you're being managed by the courts, and so you don't also need to be managed by this new Sustainable Groundwater Management Act. So adjudication, Sigma, and now the public trust doctrine. And the way to really think about them is that they're all parallel paths. You know, in this case, the defendant tried to argue that they didn't need to worry about the public trust doctrine because everything was going to be addressed by Sigma. Maybe an oversimplification.
Yeah.
But But the judge said, well, those are independent. Now, I think that in part of my emails to Zone 3 people is that I think it would be smart for agencies that are implementing SGMA to try to figure out how to incorporate mm-hmm. public trust considerations into the SGMA process. But that's a discretionary action if they want to try to take that approach, and it's not an automatic. So anyways, the defendants lost on the ground that, hey, SGMA is just going to take care of everything. And it kind of makes sense because, again, it's a completely different theory, you know, of laws compared to the regulatory approach taken in SGMA. So we have three parallel paths again. We have adjudications and water rights, we have SGMA, and we have the public trust doctrine. I went up to a North County groundwater basin meeting on SGMA last week, kind of curious, saw some old friends, and somebody, and I'm not sure, it might have been a reporter for the New Times, but somebody asked a really astute, well, if these things are all parallel paths, when do they come together? And we say, well, we'll see, right?
Wrong
but that's map. The idea is they should at some point in time dovetail. And so if somebody can develop a SGMA plan that also addresses public trust doctrine issues, then they're going to be ahead of the game. What we find is a lot of times people are just very resistive and they end up doing themselves a disservice.
What's the process? How far along is a habitat conservation plan?
Well, it's only been about 20 years into it.
Yeah, I know that.
And so I really think that the county, all the agencies, are going to have to put our thinking caps back on because of this public trust determination. They were thinking that perhaps moving to the Whale Rock model could help with addressing the HCP issues, but I just don't see it anymore.
And then one other question. It was my understanding that the agricultural people had some guaranteed rights to part of that water. You know, the farmers own part of it, the communities own part of it.
Well, remember, none of us own water.
Well, yeah.
But the contracts themselves do not speak to agricultural rights. They only speak to agency rights because we're the only entities that are in contractual agreement with the county. Agriculture does not have any agreements. But agriculture is protected because this downstream release commitment, in a number of different ways, actually. One is agriculture is protected because any water that flows into the reservoir during like June, July, and August, I can't remember the exact period, anything that flows in has to be released. So we're talking about, you know, summertime flows.
Yeah.
You might have a big winter, and sometimes the creek will flow all year. But so that helps to support their riparian rights.
Mm-hmm.
But the general idea is that out of the safe yield of the reservoir of 8,730 acre feet, 4,200, the entitlement commitments are only 4,530. So the remaining 4,200 is available for downstream releases. And that has historically been far in excess of what's needed for agricultural purposes. Historically, maybe around two-thirds of that quantity, three-quarters of that quantity, was released downstream in order to support farming operations. Today, we see much more significant volume released downstream for habitat purposes, and of course, agriculture likes that because a lot of that water ends up seeping back into the ground as well.
Yeah.
It's really going to come down to what is going to happen when you know, we get into low flow situations, the creek dries up, is how much of it has to be mitigated from releases versus how much of it has to be mitigated through reductions in pumping. And that's going to be a pretty significant arm wrestling match. It's going to be the first time that, you know, people in our area are kind of pitted against each other, where the municipality's interests are not going to line up with the interests of agriculture. So it's going to be a hard issue to resolve.
Yeah, see, I don't understand why they have to let the flows during the summer months when naturally it wouldn't have happened.
Okay, so, and super, super good question. Because, under CEQA, the basic tenet is we're supposed to mitigate our impacts. And so if we build a reservoir, then, gosh, if you know, it's, the creek's going to dry up in summertime, but water's flowing in, then we got to release it, right? Mm-hmm. It's kind of, we only should be storing water that's otherwise would be flowing out to the ocean. But under the public trust doctrine, that issue of mitigating your impacts gets kind of thrown out the window. The idea is that when we invest in a public project, and it doesn't matter who it is, but we're developing a project, public project, the theories of the public trust doctrine is that you can be required to enhance your environment. You're not just required to mitigate your impacts. And that's because the public is laying out money for a public facility. And so the public trust doctrine says it's not just good enough to mitigate, but you actually have to support. And so when we have things like the Endangered Species Act, and then the idea is, you know, there's the very existence of the dam is going to have an impact on the species that arguably we're never going to be able to fully mitigate either. So even theories of CEQA would run in there. But public trust doctrine says you start spending public money on something, you have to address public trust issues.
But then we're also talking about the public fishing and hunting and all that stuff, which would imply you keep the water in the dam for the recreation. So I don't quite understand it all.
Yeah.
It's somebody else's court case, not mine.
Well, and that's where, that's right, because under on Rio Grande Creek, you have a number of different public resource issues. The one that's prominent is endangered species issues. But even fishing, or I know a guy who's been around for a few years as well, President White, and he remembers rafting down Rio Grande Creek before, you know, the levees were constructed or back in the day around when they were. So rafting issues, fishing issues, you know, all sorts of those other public uses also fall under public. Those other public uses are the easier ones to divorce from public trust.
There was also sand mining.
Yeah.
And gravel mining, too.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, but the ones that are, you know, endangered species issues are, you know, almost impossible to divorce from public trust. There's language in the Endangered Species Act that allows the, I guess, the Secretary of Interior to make a determination that the recovery of the species is not feasible. But short of that kind of determination through the federal government, we won't be able to locally dismiss endangered species.
I would argue that the Steelhead River could be brought back.
That the
Steelhead Creek could be brought back.
Well, I think there's a lot of people in our area that would really hope to see, you know, recovery of some of the species. The county's waterway management plan and a rebuilding of the levee system is intended to, you know, help support species in low flow events.
Yeah.
And I know that this year they have identified, I don't know if it's three or six steelhead in the creek that they're trying to watch.
Yeah. Well, when I was young, it was a hell of a lot more.
So what would be the process if you'd go ahead with proposing some amendments to Zone 3, or how does that?
So what we would do is we would prepare some draft language to share with the other staff and then report back to your board on responses and how everybody is thinking. Again, I anticipate that a couple of the cities are going to require, are going to need to formally seek the development of a memorandum of agreement in order to open negotiations, but at least this would give us a preliminary review on some of the responses. And and I would anticipate that they would want to put some issues on the table as well. Grover Beach has a challenge with the capacity in the pipelines, how much they can actually get delivered in a given year. We don't have that issue. But
sounds good.
So it's, you know, recommendation number one is kind of done, which is the general discussion. The recommendation number two is to authorize us. And, you know, the reality is your board could either do it formally or informally. You can say go ahead and move forward and report back, or you can, you know, do a specific or tell us not to do it.
Informally or formally?
I think of
informally.
Yeah.
Okay.
Informal. I think we all support that. Okay.
So we'll save our clout for later.
Yeah.
Moving on, item 10, hearing items. We have none. 11 and 12, received written communication and late communication.
Yeah, that was, you know, the big item was the garbage company request. So.
Yeah. Future agenda.
So in addition to that list, on the next meeting, Ms. Cassiola will have our first quarter budget report and our first quarter treasurer's report.
Okay. Anything else? We have no future hearing items.
Well, the garbage company will be down the road. Normally, what we do is we will list those once we have a date certain on the hearing.
Yeah. Well, there has to be some research done ahead of that by them. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Are we have all the outside committees been divvied up with everyone?
No.
Did we? I thought that for 2018 we were good, but that we were for 2019 we were going to be considering some changes. But
well, don't we? Isn't the first meeting of December when we do our reorganization meeting? So,
okay.
If it's okay with everybody,
Aileen to get left out.
Oh.
Is that okay with you?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, so we would reorganize the first meeting of December.
Yeah.
Okay. I had a question. We had talked a while back about maybe having a special meeting for setting the goals and priorities.
Yes.
Is that something that we want to do?
I think so. What about this idea? Normally we don't have a second meeting in either November or December because of Thanksgiving and Christmas. Mm-hmm. And this year, the second meeting would exactly fall on Christmas. But the second meeting in November is actually the week after Thanksgiving. And the challenge of putting a regular agenda item together is, of course, we've got a short week on the week of Thanksgiving, and I'd have to get it all posted then. But it would be really easy to post for, to do goals and priorities at that second meeting in Thanksgiving after second meeting in November after Thanksgiving.
That sounds like a good idea.
Yeah, sounds great.
Because otherwise, that's just going to be a hard meeting to schedule a regular agenda, but it would be an easy one to schedule for priorities and goal setting.
Yeah,
I would support that. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
I was also wondering, are we going to do a group photo with the board? Do you want to schedule that for the next meeting?
Yes, and in fact, we need to get the old board members here for their plaques. And Nicole, do you have a thought?
Sally and I won't be here for the next meeting.
Oh.
It's the FDA conference.
Well.
The one after.
The one after.
Yeah.
First one in November.
Yeah. Well, that would be timely, too, because that's formally when the new terms, the Board of Supervisors are going to make the appointments on November 4th for all of the incumbents. And so, it's kind of be the first formal meeting of the entire new board under their new terms. And we could have a little early Thanksgiving with the old board members, too.
Yeah, we could. If you could have yourself and the staff put that together, it would be wonderful.
We will do so. I know somebody who's really good at organizing that kind of stuff.
I just had one announcement, which is at the Oceano Beach Community Association meeting on November 1st, 6 p.m. at the Community Center. We're going to have the Coastal Commission Environmental Justice Team at our meeting. They'll be presenting. We're also going to take them on a little tour. show them what's going on with state parks down there at Pier Avenue, and you swing by the sewage plant as well, because those are our big environmental justice issues here in Oceano. So everyone's invited to come to that meeting.
When is it again?
It's November 1st. It's the first Thursday in November, 6 p.m. at the community center.
At the
And then I should announce that October 26th and 27th, we're going to have an open house at our, where I moved to in Atascadero. So people will get invitations, and, you know, the Brown Act does not forbid you from going to those kind of events. You just can't congregate in numbers of threes and start conducting board business.
Okay, do I hear a motion?
November 17th is our...
Our community.
Are we having any kind of advertising?
Yes. So we did include a mailer in the water bills. We're also going to be doing a follow-up with a postcard. And then third is we're coordinating with Lucia Mar...
it's already out through their PHR app.
Nicole.
So Lucia Mar uses an application called Peach Jar, and it sends it through email and text message, and it's already been uploaded and approved and distributed to the families of Oceano Elementary School.
And it also was distributed to the Halcyon email system.
I have to ask the most important thing. Will there be food?
Yes. Oceano Kiwanis has indicated that they would bring hot dogs and popcorn. And for, I don't know if it was going to be 25 cents or 50 cents, but for a good deal. And hopefully the Dodgers keep winning so we can actually call them Dodger dogs.
Okay.
We'll see. And fire trucks. Five Cities Fire said they'd be there as well.
I move we adjourn.
So moved.